All right, so I'm going to talk about the Tycho supernova remnant. And a lot of this work was done by a second-year Japanese graduate student at the Tokyo Metropolitan University. He came and visited me last summer, and then he came back earlier this spring and completed this nice work. We're very familiar with this picture of Tycho, which shows a three-color image in which we've taken the X-ray spectrum and divided it into regions where the iron L is dominant in red, silicon K in green, and then a continuum band out here. Okay. So many people have shown this figure. Some people have shown it with in a movie form. And so today I'd like to show you a new version that encodes slightly different information. So what we've done here is we've taken the long Chandra LP from 2009, and we've just focused on the silicon line, and we've essentially chosen three different channels to display in our RGB plot here. A red-shifted channel, a low-velocity channel, and a blue-shifted channel. And hopefully what you should see is patterns of red and blue knots, which plausibly come from velocity shifts, dominated the center with more green emission around the outside, indicating low-velocity material out there. So in the rest of the talk, I want to go through and convince you of the reality of this, these features, and then give you a little bit of information about what we can do using this kinematic information. So here's a brief outline of the talk. I'm going to go through, talk about radio profiles, and then double Gaussian fit to specific regions. I'll show you the mean photon energy map, a spectral analysis. We'll look a little bit about the large-scale distribution of the apparent velocities that we've seen. And then I'll talk a little bit about that very interesting southeastern region of Tycho, the region down here, where for many years we've known about its complicated morphology and spectral properties, iron-rich, silicon-rich knots. Okay, so since a lot of people haven't thought about what are the consequences of radial velocities, we've heard a lot about transverse or Doppler or proper motion velocities, I just want to go through very simply some ideas behind what we might want to expect. So we have Chandra here observing a perfectly symmetric shell-type remnant in which we have a blue-shifted hemisphere and a red-shifted hemisphere. Okay. So the emission is optically thin, so we see the front and the back. And spherical symmetry means we have very nice a balance between the two. So what do we get? We get a nice profile of the surface brightness. Okay, and I'm only showing, because it's symmetric, I'm only showing from the center to the edge, the impact parameter. So from the center to the edge, that's what we're showing here. All the blue-shifted velocities over here are completely matched with the red-shifted velocities over here, so the mean velocity is going to be zero. But the lines will be broader because the direction of these are different. So the RMS velocity seen in each impact parameter view along here will produce a profile that just depends on the projection of those velocities with respect to the line of sight. Okay? So that's sort of the very simplest expectation for an ideal case. What happens if you have a real case? So what I've done here is I've replaced the outer location of the ejecta with the location of the contact discontinuity that we got in an earlier paper with Jessica Warren. And as you can see, there are actually variations in the depth of emission that you see on the blue-shifted and red-shifted side. So now the emission is not balanced. Okay. So you see differences here. Now I'm showing a whole scale across here, the projected emission. The surface brightness shows a shell-like feature, but it's not perfectly symmetric and smooth. The mean velocity now has variations, okay? Because emission up here, that's blue-shifted, isn't perfectly matched by the red-shifted emission down here. So we get mean velocity variations. And then we also get a radial variation in the RMS velocity, which essentially goes to zero at the edge of the shell, but it can have variations in the middle. Okay, so that's sort of setting the stage for what we might expect to see. So radial profiles. Toshi was inspired by the Suzaku result by Hato et al. From 2010 using the Suzaku data on Chandra. On Tycho. And so this study divided Tycho into four annuli. more appropriate for the arc-minute angular resolution of Suzaku. With Chandra, I knew I would do this. Okay, with Chandra, we can actually make much finer angular resolution, much finer bins, because it's better angular resolution. So this is a busy plot, and I'll go through it in a few minutes, over a few minutes. But let me just show you what I'm talking about here. So we have surface brightness variations, okay? So it's intensity versus radius. Surface brightness for three different species, silicon K, sulfur K, and iron K. The middle paddles are the line centroids, okay? Again, silicon, sulfur, and iron. And this panel shows the line widths, okay? So this is the intensity that I showed you on the schematics before. This is the mean energy, again, on the schematics. And then this is the RMS velocity, again, referring back to the schematics. And the black curves show the Hayato work from Suzaku, okay? And obviously, you don't see the shell very well in Suzaku because of its poorer angular resolution. Although you can see that the silicon and sulfur shells are a little further out than the iron shell. With Chandra, of course, we get the beautiful shell-like profiles. And again, we see that the iron shell is interior to the silicon and sulfur shells. And this has been well known. So in the centroid energy, you may be able to see that there are several different curves on here. And I really don't have the time to explain why these curves, we believe, are in error and need to be adjusted down here for sulfur, for the silicon. And in fact, so what we see here is these are integrated spectra. They give sort of the line centroid from some integrated spectra. But our Chandra profile shows large jumps in the mean centroid, okay? And I hope I've convinced you in the earlier schematic that those are possibly the result of just having patchy emission from the ejecta on one side or the other side. And then the other thing I want to point out, which is actually quite important for this work, is the very deep minimum we get here in the line width, okay? So the general pattern is an increasing line width in toward the center, but then we have this important minimum region, okay? And I'll get back to that toward the end of the talk. So what Hayato et al. Did was to look at the emission from the central region and use this line width measurement and fit it with a simple Gaussian model where you have a redshift and a blue-shifted component. So we're going to do the same thing here. And we're going to take the data from that region, and we're going to do double Gaussian fits. Okay, so the fits are good. This is the silicon-sulfur band. This is the iron band. And our numerical results on the velocities we get, when we just take the differences between those two energies and relate them to a velocity, they agree quite well with Hayato. This is really an important independent confirmation because we have to worry not at all about effects of spreading photons from one angular shell to the other, which was an important thing that Hayato et al. Had to take account of for their broader PSF. So if we take the our velocity measurement and compare it with the ejecta proper motion from Satoru's paper in 2010, for which we extracted this value from his paper, we then get a distance to the remnant, about 3.8 plus or minus 3. And this now is very interesting. It's the velocity error. This is the proper motion error, okay? So we're actually at the stage where we're making better measurements of the velocity than we are of the proper motion. And in fact, to try to improve that, we need to make sure we're matching the structure of the proper motion with the structure we're seeing in velocity. And I'll get to that next. Okay, so this part was really intended to demonstrate that we are consistent with previous work on Tycho. So now we can go beyond and we can say, what more can we do with Tycho's high angular resolution? And so what we've done here is to just make a map of the silicon line, the centroid energy of the silicon line. The white regions here correspond to high energies, like 1.879 centroid energies. The dark regions correspond to lower values of the centroid energy, about 1.86. That's about 60 electron volts, which is a range of 9,700 kilometers per second, which is broadly consistent with what I just talked about for the shell expansion. It's about twice that. The dark outer rim is spurious. This is where the emission is non-thermal, so there's very little silicon line emission from there. So I think it's pretty clear what we're seeing here is not instrumental features. We're seeing something that is dominated by the remnant. Patchy emission dominated. And in some cases, the features that we see here correlate very well with features in intensity. So we now get back, we now made this color map again and used it plus the mean centroid map to extract various the spectral extraction regions. And so we selected 33 knots. There's 16 in the middle. There's 11 around the edge. And then there's a set of six down here in the southeast region. And four of them labeled here, we actually took special care with them. We extracted data from the independent ACES-S camera, which has fully independent detector, different gain structure, et cetera, in order to test the systematic of gain issues for these CCD detectors. Showing here just the raw spectrum, the four red spectra are clearly at lower energies than the four blue spectra. So that's just sort of convincing what we're seeing in the imaging. Okay, so we did sophisticated NEI modeling. And the thing that's very interesting here is we plot here the line of flight velocity versus the ionization age. So these are the two parameters that will be strongly influencing the line centroid. And as you can see, we make a robust determination of the line of sight, even in the presence of an ability to let the ionization timescale vary. From the comparison of the ACES-S and the ACES-I observations, we're able to assign a systematic error on the velocity of between 500 and 2,000 kilometers per second. I know that's a lot. And you can see here the difference between the ACES and the two ACES detectors over here. That's about 500 kilometers per second. That corresponds to specific nodes on the detectors. Different nodes over here tend to give different value of differences. So there's a hope that with better gain calibration or an independent measurement of the gain, we might be able to do better in constraining these velocities. The other thing you might wonder about is a particular knot on the front side, for example, may be projected over emission from the knot or the diffuse shell in the background. So if you use a local background in order to subtract out the emission from the other hemisphere, you actually increase the mean velocities by something like 1,000 to 2,000 kilometers per second. So if you put all this together, you get a conservative allowed range of radial velocities of between 7,800 on the negative side and about 5,000 kilometers per second. So I don't have time for this, but I can actually do this quickly, it's just one slide. So if you look at this pattern of mean centroids, it's pretty clear that there's an asymmetric distribution. So when we looked at this, we thought, wow, asymmetric explosion, et cetera. And so you can actually see that the north, the pixels in the north have a higher mean photon energy than the pixels in the south, okay? And the velocity difference that corresponds to is 2,000 kilometers per second, all right? But that's only a small fraction of the 4,000 kilometers per second that they're expanding, that the two shells, the hemispheres, front and back, are expanding. And in fact, if the density is different in the front versus the back, and even as small as a factor of 2 difference can result in this 2,000 kilometers per second difference. So this in no way is evidence for an asymmetric explosion. It's just evidence for the patchiness of the ejecta. And the region, and it's likely that this northern region on the near side is just interacting with the denser interstellar material. I will leave the southeastern knots for questions because I have zero time. And I will just talk about, very quickly, about the ion temperatures. So where that line width is minimum, we determined we were able to measure the minimum width and use that under the assumption that we're seeing thermal broadening to determine the temperature of the ions. Silicon, sulfur, and iron, they're all about 1 MeV. You can't trivially compare them to the properties of the reverse shock. In fact, we're using Carlos's 1D models. And so what we observe is down here for the ions, 1.2 MeV, and the electron temperature is 1.3. These are what we get from reading off Carlos' model. So this is a quick summary of what we've done with the radial profiles, the silicon line center map, our spectral analysis with the NEI models, and the observed ion temperatures, which are consistent with the 1D models. I can just say quickly that the southeastern knots are unlikely to be related to the high velocity features we see in the light output spectrum. And my final point is an outlook. This project was initiated in preparation for Hitomi observation. Sadly, Hitomi was lost earlier this year. But our study shows the richness of what we can do with the kinematic studies, with kinematic data on supernova remnants. And it would be worthwhile to do more before we get Athena or Hitomi-like recovery mission. So I want to point out that the Chandra HET has observed CASE and G292. We've heard about certainly about the G292 earlier. And Sang-Woo Park is leading an observation of Kepler this year. And so hopefully more remnants will be observed with the Chandra HETG, and perhaps even one approved this cycle. Thank you.
We have a little bit of time to add to for one or two questions. They're relatively quick. Yohako? I mean, Carla?
I just want to see the knot slide.
Okay, thank you. I didn't put that forward. Anyway, what we've done is to measure the radial velocities of these six knots. And as you'll see here, they all run like this. Okay, so they're not negligible. They're a little bit negative. So that means they're coming out of the plane of the sky by about 24 degrees. And the fits are actually interesting. We do see some chromium in some of the individual knots. So what the Toshki did was to put together this 3D model trying to relate the location toward the southeastern knots and the location toward the light echo. The idea was maybe these knots that we see now in Tycho were somehow part of what the light echo saw. And the problem is we're about 58 degrees away from the southeast knots. Okay, so it's very unlikely that these southeast knots were actually seen as the high velocity. Oh, here, this is the these are the high velocity calcium 2 features seen in the Tycho light echo spectrum. And so it's unlikely that those are related. So I think it would be extremely important to actually get a spectrum of the light echo that's down in this direction. I know Armin has some echoes down this way. It'd be really important to see that because those will have a more direct view toward this feature.
Any other questions? Quick, one last.
Hi, Jack. Very nice talk.
Thank you. So
maybe it somehow confused us, but did you calculate a new distance for Tycho?
No, that's consistent with the Hayato at all.
Okay, thank you. So this is 3.8 kiloparsecs plus minus 1 or something like this. It wasn't on the slides.
Yes.
Okay, that's further than I normally believe, but interesting. Thanks.
Okay, let's thank our speaker again.